Okay, so there are quite a few different models of quantum computation, such as the search model and adiabatic and quantum locks and topological one-thing qubit and so on. But, these have different uses. So one purpose of having more than one model is that maybe one of these will be easier to implement. Maybe it'll be more fault tolerant and so forth. And another reason is that by thinking in these different points of view, it may allow you to arrive at algorithms that you wouldn't otherwise think of. So today I'll talk about a new, sort of propose a new model of quantum computation, which I'm calling the permutational quantum computing model. And it is closely related to the existing topological quantum computing model, which some people may be familiar with. And so I'll just devote the first few slides to reviewing that. And almost everything I'll say on these first few slides is actually common to both models. So in topological quantum computing, you have some physical system with a degenerate ground space, and you have some excitations, which are quasi particles, and they are anionic as far as exchanging them around. And so if you adiabatically drag these things around each other, then their word lines trace out some braid, and the braid determines the computation. So you end up in a different state within this ground space, and so you have a unitary representation of the braid group that gets applied to this this degenerate space. So for example, there's a well-known model called the Fibonacci anions. Some people think it may arise in certain quantum Hall systems. And if you take a braid like this on three particles, this sense of being a two-dimensional space, and there's the unitary representation of that particular braid. And there's another important part of the story, which is besides just braiding things, you also have fusing and splitting of particles. So in a way, you could think of this initial part of the computation as being a state preparation. And here, these labels indicate what particle type you're basically splitting from. And then the final state you can think of as a measurement. So here you're measuring the particle type that you get by fusing these and by fusing these. And when you specify these labels, you're specifying the initial and final state. And this gives you back one matrix element of the representation you get of this braid that happens in between. So this system where you have a set of fusion rules and a set of braiding rules, it's not just any old representation of the braid group. These have to obey certain consistency conditions. So here's just one example of that called the Pentagon identity. And so it says if you do these moves, or if you do these moves, you end up not only in the same diagram, but the same unitary transformation. And this kind of mathematical structure with recoupling moves, which they call F, and braiding moves, which they call R, is something that gets studied a lot under the name of tensor categories. And so, as I said, there's two points for such a model. One is maybe you get a new implementation of quantum computers, so you might find some physical system, such as maybe a quantum Hall system that actually has these anions. And besides that, you also arrive at some algorithms by thinking this way. And the topological model is a good example of this because it's from this model that you can really get the idea that quantum computers might be able to efficiently approximate Jones polynomials, an idea which would probably not be too obvious otherwise. So I'll briefly talk about that because it has an analog in the permutational model. So here's a braid. It's just some braid on four strands. So by closing the ends of the braid together, top and bottom, you end up with a knot, or more generally a link. And two ways of doing this are in neighboring pairs like this. That's called a clat closure. or you can just connect each strand around to this corresponding one on top. And that's called the break closure. The trace closure. And so a certain matrix element of this exact representation of the braid group that you get from actually braiding around the Fibonacci hennions is equal to the Jones polynomial of this knot that you get from the flat closure of that braid evaluated at e to the i to pi over pi. And it turns out that this is a V2P complete problem, which means that not only can you solve it in a non-quantum computer, but anything that you can solve on a quantum computer reduces to this. So this is very closely related to the statement that this topological model of quantum computation is equivalent to say, the circuit model. And if you do the trace closure, instead of the matrix element of this representation, you get the trace of the representation, in other words, a character. And this problem is a little easier because you're getting less information. You're not getting a matrix element, you're sort of getting an average of all the matrix elements in the diagonal. And this problem, instead of being complete for standard quantum computation, is a complete problem for DQC1, which is the one-thing qubit model of computation, where you start with a high entropy initial state. So now let's move to the new and closely related model, which is permutational. So first, some motivation. So in topological quantum computation, one of the claimed advantages for it is that the details of the local geometry of how you're moving these particles around doesn't matter. If you get your braid a little bit off, your trajectory a little bit off, as long as you're in topologically the same braid, you can still get the same computation. So then, this might be advantageous if you don't have really high precision in your control of these particles. And also, in a certain sense, this degenerate ground state is the information that is being stored in degrees of freedom that are not associated with individual particles. They're sort of global degrees of freedom, which might be harder for the environment to decohere. So now let's sort of take this and extrapolate it one step further. Instead of ignoring just the geometric details, ignore even the topological details, and all you retain, the only thing that determines your computation, is how you've permuted particles. So basically, this is saying that we now no longer distinguish overcrossings and undercrossings. If you take away that distinction, you go from the braid group to the symmetric group. So this is sort of anticipating what I'll say in the rest of the talk. In the topological model, you need sort of exotic particles called hennions, which exist only potentially in two dimensions. In the permutational model, you're really just permuting spin 1/2 particles. And as I said, instead of braiding them, we just permute them. So instead of the braid group, we're going to consider representations of the symmetric group. We have also an analog of diffusion rules. This is, again, something more fairly mundane, which is just measuring total angular momentum of sets of these spin 1/2 particles. And the set of fusion and permutation rules that we get in this case also forms a tensor category that obeys certain identities, such as the one I showed you, and this is something that is known and has been studied.
Sue?
Yes?
If I were to do this starting with a 2D anionic system,
yeah,
and then just sort of close one eye and say, I'm going to forget the topology, but the system still remembers how I did this, is it sufficient to just, in my own head, say I'm going to forget it, or do I have to actually introduce a third dimension and go to a system that doesn't remember the topology?
Well, so you wouldn't necessarily need to go into three dimensions. I mean, you could have some representation of the braid group, I believe, which factors through the symmetric group so that the representation is non-faithful enough that it's ignoring this undercrossing and overcrossing distinction.
But if I have a faithful representation and I just forget about which way I did the grades, will there be physics in the anionic statistics that sort of screw this up?
Well, it really depends on the actual physical system. You know, in the case of the anionic systems, it depends on, you know, what your material is, and that determines what sorts of quasi-particles arise in it. So it's not just a matter of deciding whether you're going to keep track of what's happening in some ancillary register or something like that. It's really a property of the physical system. Okay, so now I'll actually get into the details of how to construct this model. So we're going to build it all out of spin angular momentum. We're never going to consider, in the end, we're going to ignore all the azimuthal angular momentum along specific axes. We're just going to talk about total angular momentum. So, so if you have, here are some angular momentum operators for individual spins. We can sum them up, and we can take the square of that. So this is some total angular momentum for all n spins. And we label its eigenstates, these values j like that. So this is all very standard. So this is an operator that you can decompose into poly matrices, and it's just a two-local operator. Now, the one thing to observe about this commutes with any permutation of the particles. So that means that the eigenspaces of this operator transform as representations of the symmetric group. It also turns out that these representations are irreducible. And we know how to identify them. If the total angular momentum is j, then this corresponds to the irrep of the symmetric group, where the Young diagram has an overhang of j. So the number of boxes in the first row minus the number of boxes in the second row is j. And there's only two rows. I mean, it's 2j. So this is, this is sort of reminiscent of the topological model, but we're still missing a few ingredients because we haven't introduced any fusion rules, just permutation. And also, we've talked about these representations so far only abstractly. We don't have a basis yet. But actually, these two questions are ultimately related, and we can answer them both at once. So what we need is some more operators that commute with this total angular momentum operator. And we have once we have a large enough number of commuting operators, then the simultaneous eigenvalue of these can specify individual states within this space. So some more operators we can make which commute with this are total angular momentum of subsets of these spins, and also some azimuthal angular momentum, say total z. So in this case, for the example of three particles, these three operators form a complete commuting set. So by writing down, they simultaneously diagonalized, writing down the eigenvalues, we get a specific statement.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what is that. The z, what is that?
Oh, these are sigma z. So
okay.
In quantum computing, they just write them as z. Okay, so now we have a basis. And so let's see how the representations of S3 look in this basis for those three spins. So first of all, the total angular momentum, as I said before, tells us which irreducible representation we're in. This angular momentum of the first two is going to label basis states that are within a given irreducible representation. And this total azimuthal angular momentum in the z direction we picked arbitrarily, this turns out to be an irrelevant degree of freedom. That it just, if you're in a certain eigenspace of this, all your permutation doesn't change which eigenspace you're in. And besides that, the representation looks the same, independent of what this what eigenspace this operator you're in. So ultimately, we're just going to ignore this degree of freedom, as if, you know, in a, say, a qubit computer, you had one extra qubit out there in the universe somewhere. It's an intensive product with your computational qubits, and you just don't really care.
So the third one is that's actually a basis for the SU2 part of the Schur-Weyl decomposition, right? I think the answer is yes. I'm trying to figure out how you got to this. Like, the last one is not rotationally invariant.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is just the standard S squared.
Mm-hmm.
But how did you settle on then S1 plus S2 squared? Like, maybe if you had four particles, what would these be?
Well, so there's different choices. And in fact, for n particles, there's exponentially many different choices. So, this works a little better. So, what you can do is, these things only commute if they're disjoint or one is a subset of another. These total angular momentum operators are different subsets of spins. So the way I've chosen, one particular way that turns out to be very handy for choosing these operators is just to choose the whole set, then all but one, and then all but two, and so on like this. And you can also draw this as a tree. So you're just joining in more and more spins and writing down total angular momentum of increasingly large subsets of these spins.
And that's exactly sufficient to label all the states.
Yeah, except for this extra Z thing. So this is one choice, and it turns out to be a particularly good choice, which you'll see why in a few minutes. This is kind of repeating what I said on the other slide from another point of view. So here, total angular momentum are labeling gear ups of your representation of the symmetric groups, these 2D blocks. Here's a 1x1 block, and here's a 2x2 block, and the individual states within this block are labeled by the total angular momentum of just the first two. And then this gets repeated identically for different values of the Z angular momentum. So as I was kind of getting into on the board there, already we can see in the case of three spins that there are two choices of basis here, depending on whether we pair together the first two spins or the last two spins. And so for a given tree corresponds to a given choice of basis, the different labelings correspond to orthogonal states. So that's just because these labels right here are really just eigenvalues of these angular momentum operators, and of course, different eigenvectors are orthogonal. Then for different choices of trees, so here's the one where we're coupling 2 and 3, and here's the one where we're coupling 1 and 2, we have a change of basis linear transformation between these, and this is going to be labeled by 6 objects, so this is, you can think of it as a 6 index tensor, and we just sum over this extra one that we've now introduced. These all are the same on both sides. And this is actually, other than a normalization factor, it's essentially a 6J symbol. And these are going to be very important. So as I said, here's a 6J symbol, which may be familiar. Here's our normalization constant and phase in front. So this is what our change of basis looks like. And in fact, what's going to be important is that these 6J symbols are efficiently computable classically, provided that the values inside here are only polynomially large. So there's just actually an explicit formula known for these 6J symbols in terms of summing up various ratios of factorials and so forth. So it turns out that now that we have once we have just two simple rules, we can build up everything about this system of spins and how it behaves under recoupling and permutation. So the first rule we have is a rule for a two-particle exchange. So if we have a total spin A, which divides into two pieces that each have total spins B and C, Then when we exchange those B and C particles, then we get a phase of minus 1 to B plus C minus A. So an example of this is the singlet and the triplet. Here, if B and C are a half and A is 0, we get a minus 1. If B and C are half and A is 1, we just get a 1. So this is nothing exotic. So then, besides this exchange rule, we have the coupling rule. And between the two, we can construct anything. And we can construct a representation of the symmetric group. So here's how we do that. Let's suppose we want to understand the representation of this permutation. We can't do that directly by this exchange rule, because this is just telling us how to exchange particles that split off from the same branch. So what we can do is first use our recoupling rule, which we know and can compute, to recouple the diagram to this, then use our exchange rule, and then recouple back. So FRF inverse gives us our representation for this generator of the symmetric group. And it turns out that if you choose this coupling scheme, which is the one I drew on the board here, the representation of the symmetric group that you get is a very familiar and long-known basis, which is referred to as Young's orthogonal form. And basically, this is kind of the standard basis for writing representations of the symmetric group, which was written down, constructed purely algebraically long before quantum mechanics came around. So it's kind of nice to get it from this physical method. So just for concreteness, let me tell you exactly what Young's orthogonal form is. So here we have elements of the symmetric group acting on some vector space. We can think of this vector space as being the formal span of the standard Young tableau of a given shape. So the shape tells you which irreducible representation you're in, and then the basis is given by different ways of labeling these boxes. So in this case, there's only two allowed ways of labeling this, 1, 2, 3, and 1, 3, 2. So here's the rule that just completely specifies the representation. If you have a given Young tableau, then this is the exchange of objects I and I plus 1. You imagine that this is nice, exchanging n objects. And then this will be a linear combination of this same Young tableau plus the one that has boxes I and I plus 1 exchanged. And the coefficients for this are just given by these simple formulas, where this tau I is called the axial distance between objects I and I plus 1, where you just count how many hops it takes you to get there. In this case, it's 1, 2. You have to count hops to the left and downwards positively. So here's an example of what the representation of sigma 2 is. So this is a completely concrete and easy to compute representation for these swap operations, which are the generators of the symmetric group. So implicitly, it defines a representation of the entire symmetric group. But for arbitrarily complicated permutations, it may no longer be easy to compute, because it will be a product of these matrices, which in general are exponentially large, even though the individual matrix elements of them are easy to compute for these set of generators.
So there are signs, so tau is not necessarily. You have a minus 1.
Right. Tau can be negative or positive, yeah.
How do you choose the sign?
The sign depends on, so if you count hops this way positively and this way positively, negatively are up and to the right. So then you just add that up. If you're in column C okay. So here's an example where it would be negative. Here's 1, 2, 3. So the distance from 2 to 3 is now going to be minus 2 because it's minus 1 to go like this, minus 1 to go like that.
What happens if you were swapping 1 and 2?
If you try to swap 1 and 2, these coefficients end up being 0. And so that's why it doesn't take you out of the...
You mean the second?
The second coefficient ends up being 0.
Okay.
So that's why it doesn't take you out of the space of valid standard Young Temporal. And this picture in terms of tableau exactly can be mapped in a one-to-one way to our picture in terms of angular momentum. So you could think of a standard Young tableau as the instructions for a sequence of moves to build the final Young diagram. So I'll say, here's a Young tableau labeled like this. So this means add this box first, then this box, then this box, then this one, then this one, then this one, in a sequence like that. And correspondingly, these angular momenta, okay, so here the overhang is 0, so that's a 0 here. Here the overhang is 1, that means 1 half here. Here the overhang is 2, 2 halves here, and 1 and 2, like that. So these exactly correspond. That's the relationship between these bases. So the most general process you can have in this model is you have some state preparation where you can have things coupled in any arbitrary way and then permuted in any arbitrary way. Then you have some other measurement that you're going to choose. You're going to measure whichever subsets of these spins you want. And you want to know the amplitude from going from this state to this one. So a nice way of diagrammatically representing this is just take the mirror image of this thing, just flip it up and paste them together, and now we have a diagram which really sort of in time represents this process where we're doing state creation, permuting around, and then measuring. Now this A label and this C label have to be the same. By permuting, you can't change the total angular momentum. So we can just, if we want, just tie these two strands together and call this our process. So this diagrammatic notation is kind of nice because it doesn't really matter how you draw it. You can just move these strands around however you want, and it's still the same amplitude. So you can deform this thing to add a lot of extra crossings. Even you can have something where a coupling used to happen before a crossing and then used to happen before, and now it happens after. And the only thing you need to keep track of is which strand goes into which slot of these little disks, of these little joining places here. You can't just swap them for free. And you have to keep track of which values are feeding into here. Now, from the point of view I've used so far, this is not necessarily obvious, but there is a very simple way of proving this, which is that these amplitudes can be computed by associating a Clebsch-Gordan tensor with three indices with each of these black dots. And just these lines here are telling you which indices to contract. So from that point of view, it's completely obvious that when you drag these lines around, you haven't done anything. And this, I think, is closely related to what's sometimes referred to as spin networks, these kind of SE2 label diagrams. So we now have completely specified a model of computation. We've at least defined it now. So we prepare a basis state from some complete set of commuting angular momentum operators. We permute the spins around however we want, and then we measure some other complete set of commuting angular momentum operators. And we also have, sort of for free, one problem which you can solve, which is we know that it can approximate matrix elements from Young's orthogonal form. And we know this just because it's a known fact that this basis corresponds to Young's basis. Now, I should also mention that this model is closely related to one that does exist in the literature already. Although it is somewhat different because in the model proposed here, you also allow some additional operations which are not discrete, in which cause their model to immediately equal the BQP in its power, this power standard on computers. So one of the most basic questions to ask about the model is, how powerful is it? Is it as powerful, equally powerful to a standard quantum computer, more powerful, less powerful? And so first I'll just tell you what I suspect is the answer, and then I'll tell you the things that I can actually prove. So this diagram shows complexity classes. What these circles, what these sets are, is a set of problems solvable with a given set of resources. So this is, this BQP is a set of problems solvable with a standard quantum computer in polynomial time. P is a set of problems solvable in polynomial time classically. And here's what I've tentatively named the class of problems solvable with these permutational quantum computers. So what I suspect is that this permutational model is weaker than the full power of standard quantum computation, but still able to solve some problems which cannot be solved in polynomial time classically. So that's what I think, and here's what I actually know. So first of all, I can show for sure that this model is contained in BQP. In other words, you can simulate this with a quantum computer, which is probably not too surprising. And another thing is, well, of course, as we've seen, you can approximate these matrix elements from the Young's orthogonal form. And if you look in the existing papers about how to compute these matrix elements classically, you find that all the known algorithms, even though people have devoted some effort to speeding them up, are still exponential time in the worst case. So in fact, there is a pile of papers that people have written about this. It's not just a problem that nobody cares about except me. It's something that people have actually tried to solve classically. Okay, so first of all, I'll sketch the reason how we can see that this model is simulatable on a standard computer.
Sorry, Stephen, do you mean that it's strictly contained, or you mean?
No. This no. Depends on what notation you use, but I don't mean that it's strictly contained. It could be equal.
Yeah, okay.
It seems to me that some books use this to mean containment that is not necessarily strict, and some always put in this little underline. Maybe I'm wrong, but certainly I don't mean that it's strictly contained. Okay. All right, so one way to show this is, let's just pick a basis to always work in. That's what we usually want to do to actually compute things. So let's pick this basis, the same one that we've been talking about all along, this Young and Nucci, Young's orthogonal form. So we can then make a register of qubits just writing down these numbers in there. So how do we construct, do the state construction? Well, we do it just as we did it diagrammatically, by a sequence of moves of recoupling and interchanging of neighboring particles. So to interchange neighboring particles, we have to apply this minus sign, so that's just a diagonal unitary. And for recoupling, we need to implement these 6J unitary transformations. So by those sequence of moves, provided we can do them, we can make any possible state that you can get on this type of computer. And then to find inner products between these states, polynomial precision, we can use a standard quantum computing trick called the Hadamard test. But for non-quantum computing people, you could just think of it as interferometry, because that's basically what it is. So obviously, this move is easy to implement on a quantum circuit. It's just a diagonal unitary with plus ones and minus ones down the center, down the diagonal, and whether it's a plus one or a minus one is trivial to compute. Now, this unitary transformation is a little bit trickier, potentially, but it has some nice features. So first of all, it's sparse. So that means if you start with some state and write it in this recoupled version, this sum is only going to be over a modest number of of values here, only polynomially many. And secondly, we can efficiently compute what all these non-zero entries in any row or column of the unitary are, because we know this Rakoff formula, which is just some sum of factorials and stuff, which you can just compute easily. So this suggests that maybe you can do this efficiently with quantum circuits. And in fact, you can make a completely general statement that whenever you have a sparse unitary with efficiently computable entries, you can always implement it with a quantum circuit. And so let me explain one trick for doing that. So there's existing work on how to simulate sparse Hamiltonians. And this is due to Richard Cleave and also some others. So this is known. And you can reduce the problem of simulating these sparse unitaries to the problem of simulating sparse Hamiltonians, because if you take the unitary and make a block matrix like this, all zeros here, u and u dagger here, now you have a sparse Hamiltonian. It's Hermitian and it squares the identity. And since it squares the identity, you can see pretty easily that e to the I Hamiltonian times pi over 2 is just going to be an irrelevant phase times this matrix back. And we can do this using the standard Hamiltonian simulator stuff. And this trick was something that Pavel Votsian and I noticed a while ago, and it's more general than necessary to solve this problem, and it does solve it. It turns out also this has been noticed by other people previously, including Andrew Childs, but I'm not sure if it's been published before. So far what we've seen is that this permutational model is definitely contained in BQP. It may or may not be a strict inclusion. Yeah.
What I was going to ask you is, does it contain P?
You have to be pretty technical about how you define it to decide whether it contains P, because you have some machine that's controlling what the sequence of moves on here is going to be, and it's counting the sampling that you get when you do measurements at the end. And if this machine is a standard computer, you get P automatically. But it could be maybe, let's say, a log space machine or something like that. And then it's not clear that it necessarily contains P. So that's why in this diagram, I just displayed as being incomparable with P. Okay, so we know it's contained in BQP. It appears that it may not be contained in P because you can solve this problem, which the best classical algorithms are to measure time. I should say, though, that to be fair, this thing only gives you these matrix elements with polynomial precision, and the classical algorithms are all, you know, basically exact up to numeric precision. So it's not clear that people have necessarily tried too hard to get approximations to this problem. That's one caveat to this evidence, that it might not, that it's not contained in P. So one of the most obvious and pressing questions to ask is whether this model is equivalent to BQP, the standard quantum computation. So my suspicion is that it's not, and I have two reasons for that. One of them is a kind of basic reason, which is that the symmetric group is finite. And so whereas the set of quantum circuits on a fixed number of qubits is infinite, and all the proofs that they use in the topological case to show attainment of that these models are equivalent to BQP always use the fact that the Bray group is infinite. And they use it in a very essential way, because this is what allows them to have representations of the Bray group which are dense in a continuous unitary group. And so those kind of proofs cannot possibly work in this case. That's one reason. And now here's Another thing which I'm going to introduce, which may appear to be a digression, but in fact is, I believe, related to this question about the relative power of BQP and this permutation law. So here we have the braid group and the symmetric group, and here we have the problem of approximating matrix elements of the representations to polynomial precision, and here's the problem of estimating normalized characters to polynomial precision. So as I mentioned earlier in reference to Jones polynomials, we know that this matrix element problem for the braid group is BQP complete, so it's equivalent to universal quantum computing. And this problem of approximating characters is complete for one clean qubit. So this problem corresponds to a complexity class which is probably weaker than BQP, than standard quantum computing, yet still capable of doing some things that classical computing is not. Now here, we know that for the symmetric group, the matrix element problem is contained in BQP. That's what I just sketched for you. And then this is the result that I'll tell you next, which is that the problem of estimating characters, normalized characters of the symmetric group, can be done in BPP, which is basically almost the same as P. This is just classical computing, polynomial time, and you have access to random numbers. So we see that this character problem appears to be easier than the corresponding character problem for the braid group. So maybe the matrix element problem is easier than the matrix element problem for the braid group. Okay, well, let me skip this. So now, how do we know that estimating the normalized characters of the symmetric group can be done in classical polynomial time with random numbers? Well, the proof has only two steps, but each step is using some higher powered theorem that somebody else proved. So here they are. So the first higher powered theorem that you can just use is that here's a formula that for the characters. So it's a sum over all Young tableau of a given standard Young tableau of a given shape of this factor, which in every case is 0 plus 1 or minus 1. And these factors are given by products of a polynomial number of these terms in the sum are each given by a product of polynomially many things, which are each plus 1, minus 1, or 0, and can be easily computed. So that's, for our purposes, all we need to know about this theorem. The second thing you need to know is that it's possible to sample uniformly in an efficient way from the set of standard Young tableau of a given shape. And this is not trivial to do, but these guys figured out how to do it. And so by putting these together, you just sample from these Young tableau. Each time you get these plus 1, minus 1, and 0, you average them up by the sampling procedure. And you, by doing this, you get the same level of precision that you would get from a sum function of a, well, what you get is the normalized character to polynomial precision, which is analogous to what you get with one clean qubit computers. So to summarize what I have so far, we have a model that's like topological quantum computation. What we permute is spin one half particles instead of Brady anions. The resulting complexity class is contained in BQP. This can do a problem that's probably sort of hard classically. And the corresponding computational model based on characters is contained and can be simulated efficiently classically. So there are a number of open questions and as well as reasons to believe that this might be an interesting result. So one is that, well, as we saw, we can compute the Young's orthogonal form. We can also compute 3 NJ symbols. And basically, the difference is these are a little bit more general. Here, you don't pick the same tree as your initial and final state. And these are something which are a little more closely tied to angular momentum and spin networks, but include this as a special case. And so another question is, well, these spin networks arise in many physical models, including quantum gravity. They can be used to describe geometry of manifolds. And in particular, as I understand it, in the Ponzano Reggi model, you exactly use these same SU2 recoupling-based spin networks. So as we said, models have different purposes. One is for finding quantum algorithms. We got this one directly from thinking about this model. From the point of view of thinking about this model, it may seem sort of an obvious application. But without thinking about this model, you wouldn't necessarily think of the idea of pursuing these algorithms. So, of course, you could actually imagine doing this procedure with angular measuring angular momentum used to describe the model. This has some nice features. The degrees of freedom that contain your computational data are non-local because you're looking at total angular momentum of sets of qubits. So this may, they're not associated with individual spins. So this may make them harder to decode here. And you can ask, well, what about even closer analogy to topological quantum computing? Could you have some material which has quasi-particles that really obey the statistics of these higher dimensional representations of the symmetric group, which is called parastatistics? So, and of course, we have a potentially new complexity class. I think it's distinct from BQP, although I don't know that for sure. And proving distinctness of complexity classes is a notoriously hard problem. So this is basically like the BQP, the P versus NP problem. But there is at least, besides the arguments I've mentioned before, there's another sort of standard trick that complexity theorists tend to use, which is called oracle separations. So this is basically, we say, let's suppose we have this kind of computer and some additional powerful resource. Then what can you do? If you have this computer plus a certain that same extra resource, what can you do? And maybe you can prove that those things are different, which is some evidence, although not entirely strong evidence, that these things are distinct. And that's in problems like P versus NP. That's really the best that people have been able to do. So since I have a little bit of extra time, I'll discuss one additional issue, which is to dive a little bit deeper into this question about whether it really is classically hard to approximate these matrix elements of the symmetric group. So here I'll just talk about representations of the symmetric group in general. And so if these are exponentially large, which is a potentially computationally hard case, then if these are exponentially large unitarian matrices, then the average magnitude of matrix elements is necessarily exponentially small. So then we approximate these things to within plus or minus of 1 over a polynomial amount. So for average instances, we're really learning basically nothing. If you just guess 0 every time, that's as good as what this is doing. So this might make you very worried. You know, is this really just a trivial problem? So for random instances, well, yes, we've seen for sure that this is trivial for random instances. But in worst case, it's not necessarily so. And this exact same problem arises in the case of the Bray group in finding Jones polynomials. Those matrix elements and those values of the Jones polynomial are also normalized compared to the precision level, exponentially small on average, But we know that in the worst case, that's hard because it's species hard. So, for example, so in this case, I don't have any proof hardness, computational hardness result, like a VQP hardness. So the next best thing you can ask for is, well, can we at least find some class of instances that's at least plausible to be hard? Maybe we can find some matrix elements that that are not small, are not tiny. So knowledge of the asymptotic behavior of arbitrary matrix elements of these representations is sort of hard to come by, as far as I can tell. But about the diagonal matrix elements, there's a lot more known, and you can find out about it by reading about asymptotic character theory. So here's I haven't stated precisely, but basically this is a theorem by Dion, which tells you that, let's suppose you have a sequence of symmetric groups getting larger and larger n, and a corresponding sequence of Young diagrams, such that these Young diagrams, as you get larger and larger, are converging to some fixed shape. So for example, here you keep adding more boxes so that in the limit of n going to infinity, it maps out this triangle. In that case, you can prove a very nice result about the behavior of this character as n is going to infinity. So here's the result. So this is the character of the given permutation. This is the dimension of the representation. So this is the normalized character, which is what we get to, which is what we're talking about, polynomial precision. This factor up front is something that depends only on what this limiting shape is. And here, this n is, the S of n, it's the number of things you're permuting. And this, what I denote with pi with two bars around it, is the number of points that get moved by this permutation. So if you have a permutation that leaves almost all but a constant number of the points fixed, then this is just a polynomial shrinking of this normalized character with n, in which case obtaining this to polynomial precision could be something computationally non-trivial. So I guess with that, I'll finish.
So this is cool. I like this. I have a question about the fault tolerance thing.
Huh?
You argued that because you're interested in the collective angular momentum of a bunch of particles here, that's a non-local property, and so it might be robust. But it's actually, I mean, if you flip a single one of those, then that's going to change the total spin of all of them. Mm-hmm. So it is a non-local property, but it seems like it's a fragile. It seems like this would be this is obviously robust to global rotations, but is there any real reason a priori to think that it's naturally or could be made robust to local errors?
Well, so one thing I guess you could do is try to apply some energy barrier against these kind of things. Like, for example, here your total angular momentum through the entire process is always going to be conserved, because all you're doing is permuting particles. So you could just apply some Hamiltonian all the time, which gives you an energy penalty against not having whatever angular momentum, total angular momentum you have, maybe zero or something. So in this case, doing something like flipping a spin might be an energetically costly thing. In this, so applying a Hamiltonian like this is something that commutes with all of your operations.
You'd so, still have a pair of flips, though, one in one subset go to flips and another subset.
Yeah, so.
I mean, also implementing that Hamiltonian involves couplings between.
Yeah, it's a two-local Hamiltonian. So it's not
it's truly local in terms of number of particles, but physically not at all.
Right, yeah. It's a two-body Hamiltonian, and it's physically non-local. So although it is, you know, since it only involves two-body interactions, it's not totally out of the question, but it's not exactly the most realistic Hamiltonian either. That's true.
I have a very simple question. Suppose that you have a quantum computation where you just start from a valid state and your operations are just local operations. How do you can put any phase, any rotation along the semaxis with certain precision? How would you implement that?
I think it's not necessarily true that you can implement that within this model. So this certainly within BQP you can, but it's not clear that everything in BQP can be done. Okay.
This is going to be a slightly vague question. Sorry about that. So I have for n spins, I have a bunch of airfs of SM. So, for instance, for 3, the one that you discussed, there's a two-dimensional airf. So I basically have a two-dimensional Hilbert space on which I have an S3 group. Mm-hmm. And those are the things that I can do there. But as the spins grow, I have larger and larger airfs. Mm-hmm. So if the airf was... I'm trying to figure out how non-classical these are. How big compared with, say, just classical bit strength commutations are these SN arrows? Do you have any intuition for that?
I think for N, well, you can figure out the dimension of the era by figuring out how many standard Young have will fit within your Young diagram. So let's say you have a diagram like this. So it's definitely clear that you have exponentially many choices here because put your second box here or here. Then once you've done that, you have analogous choices all along the way. So these end up another way of looking at it is it's the number of paths that end up at a given endpoint that have n steps, because this is keeping track of the overhead along here. So these things are understood combinatorically, and formulas are known for how many of these there are. It's definitely exponential there.
So I have some open plane questions. So this, you mentioned the statistics of particle dress somehow here. And the people will say, if I have an electrically set fermions, it's something to do with the time.
If you had particles that obeyed parastatistics, you would get this kind of computation sort of for free, because parastatistics is just the idea that you might have some particles where, when you interchange them, instead of having being fermions or bosons, which are the two possible one-dimensional representations of the symmetric group, it might be some higher-dimensional representation of the symmetric group. And I guess a long time ago, people really thought about these as some possibility, at least at least some people thought about these as a possibility for sort of quarks, essentially. It wasn't the quark model, but it was another competing model. But since it lost, you know, quarks were the real answer, these things have been kind of mostly forgotten as far as I can tell, and there are some reasons why you might expect that these wouldn't exist as fundamental particles. But if for some strange reason they did, you would get, you basically get this this computational model for free. You actually wouldn't necessarily only get the two row representations of the symmetric group. You potentially get all of them. You can show that this is still containing BQP. Basically, if you look back at the definition of the Young's orthogonal form, you can see that again, these are sparse unitaries with matrix elements that are individually easy to compute. So you can just say by the general result that I mentioned that those are implementable by quantum computers. And then you can build up any permutation out of at most order n squared of these generators.
So this would be possible way to integrate.
But it's still in BQP, yeah.
Okay, any more questions? So let's thank Stephen and me.